all of my work is essentially asking the same question. And I'm looking at this idea of becoming and this idea of how we discover our identity. And for many years, I asked other people to share their identity with me and in their environment. And, you know, and I was asking other people to tell me their stories. And I get very, you know, involved with people and their lives. And I spend a fair amount of time with them when I'm making portraits. But with Cherry Hill, I basically turned that on its side and said, I'm going to turn the camera on me.
Sylvia and me.
Hi, I'm Sylvia Beckerman. Join me today as I talk to an extraordinary woman who is changing the world by making a difference in her life and the lives of those around her.
This is Jona Frank. I'm here with my new book, Cherry Hill, A Childhood Reimagined. And I welcome you to Sylvia and me.
Jona, thank you so much for being here with me today. And you are a portrait photographer. You usually work on the youth side. And when I say that, I'm, you know, the youth culture. You've looked at, done photographs of high school kids across the US, young boxers. There was a Catholic school that you did, you know, photographs of. And not to kind of negate some things, but you have, your work is in many private and corporate collections, as well as museums, including the Getty Museum, SF MoMA, and the Museum of Fine Arts in Houston. And your photographs have appeared on print and online in such media as, I'm reading it, Newsweek, The New York Times Magazine, The New Yorker, Mother Jones, The Independent, and The Guardian. And one of the other things that I want to read was, I believe, an introduction to one of your books that somebody wrote. And I'm going to, I just want to read part of it. Jona's gift is to be able to see the subtle patterns, the common uniform of the school without resorting to cliche or judgment. Jona is interested in groups of people, especially young men who look and dress a similar way, that they're not so different, especially the men who, the young men who dress in a very similar way. It's not that they're, as she said, step 40, relating to the Stepford movie, the Stepford Wives. And they didn't convene in a back room and decided on next year's style of fatigues. It's because they echo each other without even realizing it. And I think that kind of gets us into the book that you've done, which is called Cherry Hill, A Childhood Reimagined, as you said. And the other thing, there's a quote from Oscar Wilde who wrote, every portrait that is painted with feeling is a portrait of the artist, not the sitter. And I think that is so true in your book, Cherry Hill, in which you really, it's a book of portraits portraying your childhood with some written word, some essays and explanations. In fact, there's a few actors who play certain roles, including Laura Dern, who plays your mom, although she looks nothing like her. So let's start at the beginning, because why go from youth culture to portraits to Cherry Hill? Tell us a little bit about Cherry Hill.
Well, I think that, you know, the idea of like, why would I go to these different cultures? Like, one thing to say to that is that I feel like all of my work is essentially asking the same question. And I'm looking at this idea of becoming and this idea of how we discover our identity. And for many years, I asked other people to share their identity with me and in their environment. And, you know, and I was asking other people to tell me their stories. And I get very, you know, involved with people and their lives. And I spend a fair amount of time with them when I'm making portraits. But with Cherry Hill, I basically turned that on its side and said, I'm going to turn the camera on me and tell my story. And I do think that all of them, you know, it's funny you mentioned that Oscar Wilde quote, and for every iteration of the book, I mean, up until maybe the last 2 months before it came out, I had a quote at the beginning of the book from the photographer Evelyn Hofer, who is a German photographer, and she says, every photograph, in reality, all we photographers photograph is ourselves in the other every time. And I felt that really reflected what I was doing in the book, which was, you know, making photographs, and that previously all of my photographs in one form or another were about my life. I mean, when I created High School, I realized when I was editing the work and I had portraits up all around my studio that I had essentially recreated my high school experience in Cherry Hill, and that I could go through and say, oh, this was that person in high school and this was that person. And then I really understood what Evelyn Hofer meant, you know, and in keeping Oscar Wilde, was that idea that we are always photographing, reflecting back to ourselves. And
so what I wanted to ask, and I don't mean to interrupt you, but this is Zoom and that's what happened. Cherry Hill is suburbia. It's a suburban neighborhood.
I don't think you could get much more suburban. Yeah.
Well, no, I mean, I grew up in suburbia, but it is suburbia. And I believe your parents moved there back in the 60s.
Yeah, my parents actually were the first owners of our home in Cherry Hill. And that was in 1957. So they bought the home in the mid 50s, just a couple of months after they married. And that's, you know, that was where my entire childhood was. And they lived there for over 40 years. You know, and I think that all of my work does connect back to suburbia, because it is this idea of how you know, suburbia to me is very much about presentation, and every house on the block being the same, and your lawns being mowed, and everything being in order. And I feel like that was very drilled into us, that, you know, that you had to present a certain way, and you had to, take care of your house and your property and everything, like, you know, that we all reflected one another. And so that sense of searching for identity and how we find ourselves in that, that is something that I think I have explored in all of my work. And then I went much deeper, obviously, in the Cherry Hill project. So it all does connect back, I think, to this kind of suburban ideal, and very much so this idea that, you know, men would go into the cities and they would work. And the cities were, you know, if you wanted to look at the contrast of even the visual of that, the cities were gray and there was a lot of cement and there were hard edges. But the idea was that suburban was green and colorful and welcoming. I think there was this myth that was definitely propagated that women were kind of exalted in their role in the family because they didn't have to deal with the city and the harshness of that, and they could take care of the home.
And you women back then, I mean, one of the things that women were supposed to strive for was to get married, have children, and raise them in a suburban area.
Yes.
Then they had made it.
Right.
So suburbia, yes, there was conformity because everything really looked alike. The houses, maybe there were three or four models you could choose from, but they were all kind of cookie cutter. Inside, of course, would be a little bit different, but people went by whatever the trend was at that time.
Yes.
So let's go into this a little bit more and tell us, why now? I understand that you realize now, you know, all your portraits really have some of you in it. The main character isn't just really you, it's your mom. In this, you really focus on how your mother kind of fell into all of this conformity and the stereotypical woman in suburbia. Tell us a little bit how you started this and what you saw from it.
Well, I had been working on this book about boxers, and the boxers were in England. And so I would travel back and forth to England to meet with them and photograph them and interview them. And I was in Liverpool, and I just had this crazy sense the whole time I was there that I had traveled back in time. And where I was, where the boxing gym was in relation to Liverpool was very much about the distance of where Cherry Hill was to Philadelphia. And when I would be driving back and forth, and in high school, I got a job in Philadelphia. So I would go back and forth. I kept thinking about this time in my life. And then flying home, in this 11-hour flight, I would be making notes about my childhood and all of these memories that kept coming back from Cherry Hill. And so when I was putting together the boxing book and I was going through all my notebooks, I kept reading these stories about Cherry Hill and thinking, why was I so, distracted by Cherry Hill in working on this project? And oddly enough, I found this out recently, that some of the early suburbs that, the places like Cherry Hill and Long Island are based on are actually in Northern England. I mean, some of those first suburbs were in Manchester. So really? Here I was, traipsing around all of these areas that were the history of the suburbs. And somehow, that became ingrained in me of like, I don't know, I somehow absorbed it. There was also this really strange thing of everywhere I went, there was music playing from when I was in high school. And I just kept feeling like I had, traveled back in time. And I think that music is such a marker for, evoking the past and time period and putting you back into a moment. I guess in the way that we all do, talking about our childhood with friends and telling stories about our parents, I would do that. And I had these stories, and I started to think about how I could, if I was writing these stories, how I could illustrate them and how I could bring them to life, especially because a lot of the memories were things that I didn't have pictures of. And that's actually one of the things I feel like, I don't feel like the pictures in the book are proof. I feel like a lot of times photography is looked at as proof that something occurred. And I feel very much like these pictures are much more about memory. And they're about how we all carry this sense of memory. We all carry this kind of poetic memory of our lives. And we have these moments like, where we randomly remember something, if it's like on a long drive or doing some banal task, where we remember something very specific about something from our childhood and we reflect back on it. And I'm photographing those moments, those moments that essentially were meant to be forgotten. And
that's one of the things that I noticed, because we all have pictures, but we have pictures usually of what we want to have pictures of. They were purposely taken. And what you've portrayed in your book are the memories, not the memories that there are photographs that you could look through an album and say, okay, I'll pick this one out and put it in. And that's usually what's in biographies, there are pictures that exist. Mm-hmm. You created these memories, like you said, that most people a lot of times want to forget. It's not something that is there. So you really delved into your past.
And I think, for me, that is all connected to my mother, and that, that my mother was the relationship that was the most concerning to me. I mean, it had this dual thing of I wanted to both please her and that I was also worried about her, because she was unreliable. I mean, there was, I didn't know which person I was going to get day to day. But all of it came out of a place of feeling concerned about her and feeling like I wanted to make sure that she was given the attention that she needed. So the book is definitely about how she was formative in my upbringing and but it is, you know, but I also think it is very much about the struggles that everybody faces growing up, and that this sense of how do we break away and how do we find ourselves and how do we make choices for ourselves? I mean, how do we listen to what we truly want rather than listening to what we should be doing from somebody else's perspective? I mean, does that make sense? The sense of like, we're kind of dominated by the shoulds in our life, and that, that I think sometimes that gets, it makes getting to the things that, to really listening to yourself very hard, you know, like that gets very fogged.
Well, one of the first things that you talk about, in the book, when it, in fact, even before it starts, is the telephone ringing, your mother answering the phone, you're in first grade and she's talking to your first grade teacher. And you can't figure out why. And the explanation is one that, you know, in art class, you're given a blank piece of paper and you're supposed to draw something and you never did. And when your mother asked you why, you liked that blank piece of paper. Your mother evidently thought about this for a minute, but being one who needed to conform, she told you, now on, you're going to do something.
Right.
What'd you wind up doing?
So I drew a house with tulips, usually three tulips, over and over and over. Over and over and over.
But you did what you were supposed
to. I did what I was told. And the message was, don't be the one to stand out. Don't be the one to try to just conform. Just fall in line and play. Do not stand out and put me in an awkward situation. And I got that message. And I got that message pretty clearly through her body language and through her, through the tone of her voice, that I was doing something that was wrong. It's funny because I remember like working on that story and then adding later the line of, I didn't know that anyone noticed. And that sense of, you know, I had no, I was just in my head. I was just this flighty, dreamy kid enjoying looking at the paper. And that sense that, you know, you just have to do it to do the assignment to fit. Like, there wasn't interest in what I was imagining. There was just interest in getting it done. And so that was, you know, and then that sort of does spur on the sense of, you can be having a perfectly nice day and that phone can ring and everything can go in a different direction quickly.
So at what point, I mean, as you're growing up and you're going through all this catharsis and these memories coming back, the whole idea of growing up in suburbia, when did it come to the realization to you that your mother was playing a role? And it's not, and I don't mean just the role of, you know, mommy, but she was conforming to what she thought she needed, who she thought she needed to be, living in this wonderful suburban home.
So you're asking, when did I realize that my mother was trying to play this role?
Yes.
I mean, that's a really good question. I don't know if I had a sense of that at all as a child. I feel like so many things, you don't realize the situations you're in. You just figure out how to navigate them as a kid. And you really don't have any place else you can go. I mean, your sense, it's not like you can go, you know what, I'm going to find someplace else to live, or I'm going to go someplace else for a while everything gets worked out here, because this is really awkward or this is uncomfortable. I mean, you have what's in front of you, and that's all you really know. And I don't think I've realized how split I was about kind of wanting to explore my own creativity and also wanting to fulfill some desire for my mother until I was much older. I remember once someone, when I was in college, somebody came home with me for a weekend or something, and they said, "Why, your mom is so competitive with you." And I was shocked. I was like, what are you talking about? Like, I, you know, but she was, I mean, you know, she did have, there was this sense of competition, and it's just that I didn't see it. I mean, the other thing too, is that I had three older brothers and I was the fourth. And here I, it was like, I was her prize. I mean, finally she had the girl, and that girl was going to be able to reflect back at her. And, you know, and that's very much what the cover of the book is about. Like you say that the images, and you're accurate 100%, that the images inside are reflective of memory, and often memories we don't want to remember. But the cover is really meant to be that Kodak moment, that moment when everything is in place and look at this, and it's all set up and it's all working. And, you know, and then there's another image from that cover later in the book, which kind of tells a different story. But this whole thing of like presentation, it's interesting to me because a few people in conversations have brought up with me, you know, your mother was playing a role, and she was playing the role of the suburban housewife and all of those advertisements and everything. I mean, she was fulfilling that role, and she came to it late. I mean, she didn't enter this at 21, 22. She entered it at 29. I think that she wasn't sure that was going to be her future. So this was like everything had fallen into place. All her dreams were coming true.
And for a lot of women at that time, that was their dream. Was their dream. I grew up in suburbia. The houses were built in the early 60s. There were three models to choose from. All of the families that moved in were in their early to mid 30s with young families. It was, you know, you really had made it because now you were living in suburbia and you could raise your children. And yes, the men did go off to work, whether it be in the city or wherever.
Right. And I think I felt very much like, as I was getting older, I wished she had chosen more, but I don't know if I wanted to question that for her, because I think I felt like I was questioning her dream essentially. But I do feel that it's hard for me not to think that some of what caused her depression was this sense of like, what is my bigger purpose? You know, what, and I think that's something that you can't really find fulfillment in another person. You've got to find that within yourself. You can't look to for somebody else to say, if you do this and this and this, I will be happy. Like, you have to do the things in your life to make you happy. And that's something I often felt from my mom. Like, she wanted me she wanted something reflected back at her and claimed that would make her happy. But ultimately, I don't think that's true. I think that, you know, that you, I mean, I am married. I have a son. I have like a career that I love, and I feel good about my life. I don't know if she would look at it and say she finds all of that. She finds happiness in that for me. I feel like, I've just chosen such a different path to get here. And I never wanted, and I still never want to stop adding to my life. I mean, I feel like, you know, that's a beautiful thing, this thing that you keep moving through life and you keep adding to it. And I didn't get that so much growing up. I didn't see that reflected in my parents. I got this sense of like, we're settled and this is fine, and we're not looking for more.
And unfortunately, that really is where some people fell into, and they didn't know how to get out of it. As I mentioned, yes, I grew up in suburbia, but to a different extent, where all five children, we all moved away, and then my parents moved, and my mother went back to college, got her doctorate actually from Columbia, and when they did sell the house and move, she was a professor. So, you know, but there were so many people who got stuck, and there are still so many people who are stuck because they can't think of any further than where they've come. And so dreams, if they had any, have been suppressed. And as you said, you don't know, you know, someone can't really get pleasure themselves by somebody else doing something. They have to be able to get it from within. So why did you decide to get actors for this? Why Laura Dern? As you've stated many times, she doesn't look anything like your mom. Yet I know that you've talked about some of her movements and how she was able to, she really acted out some of the look and had you take pictures as she was acting it out so that it wasn't just a pose.
Right, right. Well, I mean, we would actually act it out and do scenes as if we were filming it. I mean, the whole process was very cinematic and it was very much like making a movie in that I had to find locations and I had to find a house that I could dress, you know, like production design to look like my house in Cherry Hill. And you know, we had costume and makeup and everything. So, I mean, I'd never done anything at this scale. Like, in the past, all of my portraits have been in the person I was photographing in their environment or in an environment that they would choose. So controlling each aspect of this was a very different process. And Laura is someone that I met just, you know, through being a mother. I mean, it's funny. It's definitely the domestic meeting the artistic, I mean, in this situation. But we met each other years ago because our kids were in the same class. And in the way that you would connect with any parent in the class, you know, our kids connected and then we connected. And she's an art collector. And so she was very interested in what I did. And that was a really easy exchange between us. And then as, you know, as the years have gone on and she's followed my work and we talk about our day to day, I was talking about developing this project. And I knew that I wanted to work with actors because I didn't, there wasn't another way to recreate these images if I didn't have people do it. I mean, I did think for a little while, like, should I use models or should I like do something on a small scale? And it's just not what I gravitated towards. So in all our times of talking, you know, at one point I just said, would you consider playing my mother? And it is really true that sense of like hair and makeup and changing things. And also, it's still amazing to me that she did it for many reasons. And it was incredibly gracious of her and like to, you know, just that level of involvement and commitment. But for the biggest reason of, she just so understands where the camera is. I mean, when you work with somebody who has that level of professionalism, it makes your job so much easier. And one of the things that we did was we hung a lot of photographs, like old family photographs of mine that I blew up and that we hung them all over the makeup room. So she really took time absorbing those images and she would take on certain aspects of my mother from those pictures.
As a matter of fact, isn't, I don't remember whether it's the last picture, one of the last pictures where she purses her lips.
And I was amazed. I was totally amazed. And kind of that was haunting for me, especially like, you know, especially when I saw the pictures by myself in my studio and I was going through them and I really felt like, how did she do that? I mean, she really captured my mother. And she really noticed all the details of those images. I mean, it's funny, like I have, I had one experience with her and this was years ago that really woke me up to how both of us look at the world. And it was just like, you know, in this very everyday thing of, we were driving somewhere to taking our kids somewhere. And I was in the passenger seat and she was driving and we were waiting at a light and these people were going to cross the street. And there was this woman and she had on these crazy, like these red pants, but she had this stance, this thing she was doing with her body. And I noticed her right away. And I thought, if I was making her photograph, you know, or a photograph of this group, she would be the one who stood out. And just as I was thinking that, Laura said, look how that woman is standing. I want to remember that. And I thought, oh my God, we're noticing the same things in the world. You're going to take them and put them into a character. and I would make an image of them. And so that's, you know, that's a big part of what she brings to it. I mean, both of us absorb the world in a similar way. I mean, but we do it through different means. And, you know, and having that friendship and that ability to kind of talk about things day to day, rather than it being nice to meet you and this is who I want you to be. And that it just unfolded in this very organic, seamless way. And that's, you know, that's been an amazing thing. I mean, I'm like truly grateful for that friendship. But I mean, for so many reasons, her input and just her way of looking at the world. I mean, it's a great perspective to have.
Well, I'll tell you, it's not just, this book is not just a story of your life. You've actually opened up the story in such a way that is, that puts the person there because of how you did it into suburbia and what, you know, life was back then, and for some still is. And for women who are really, were stuck in a place where they didn't know what to do. A lot of people, it's not to say that there weren't people who were very happy being there, and that's exactly the life they wanted. And so, you know, therefore they have what they want. But there are so many women who, you know, they go by the stereotype and they wind up falling into maybe a depression or hiding behind it because they don't know what else to do. So I want to thank you for sharing your story because it really is a story to be told. And the wonderful way that you did it with these portraits and going through the actual, I can't think of another word, but trouble of going through that exercise of having real people portray all these characters who are your mother, your brothers, and you at various different stages in life. So what's next for you?
Well, can I ask you a question just out of curiosity?
Sure.
I'm just curious what you think, what made your mom make a difference, make that decision to say, I'm going to go back to school, because she had raised 5 kids, to say, like, I'm now going to shift and, like, look at this part of my life. I mean, that is not a common thing.
Well,
I like most people do the opposite. So it is a curiosity to me of what would have driven her.
My mother was always someone who was very driven. If she wanted to do something, she went and did it. When she first was dating my dad, he invited her to a dance. My mom lived in New Haven, Connecticut. My father was in could be Brooklyn. I don't remember. I'd have to ask my sister. My mother grew up very, very poor. But she found a way of taking dance lessons because she was not going to go to that dance not knowing how to dance. So that was one of the things that she did. When she did have the 5, and she had 5 children within 8 years. She was 20 when she had me. She was 28 when she had my brother. She always wanted to go to college. They didn't have the money for her to go. And my father, being a man, you know, during that time, wanted us to at least all be in school full time for her to do that. And she did. She went to, I forget what the name of the school was. It was one of the first accredited colleges, which gave you life experience. And so she went, she graduated from college, she got her master's, and then she went to Columbia to get her PhD. And when, I guess there are exams you need to take in order to be able to get into that program. And her counselor, guidance counselor, whatever you call them these days, I've been out of school for a long time, basically told her she was too old to really forget about it. She's never going to pass. She took the test. She didn't pass. He basically said, I told you so. She said, she went, she studied. She went back on all the other tests that had ever been given. Not only did she surpass it, pass it, but she surpassed it by numerous points that this guy was flabbergasted. It's what she had set in her mind that she wanted to do. She taught she became a nurse, then she taught nursing. When they moved to Florida, she started a senior program down there she worked for Florida Atlantic University. So she kind of instilled that in us, in myself, my sisters, my brothers. And we talked about this before, we wound up all over the US. It wasn't that we didn't want to be near each other, life just took us that way. So for me, living where I am now, there are so many people that I see who have grown up like in Stanford or Northern Connecticut, where that's where they've lived their whole lives. And as they get married and have children, they're still moving around and, you know, within distance of being able to be around family a lot, which is a nice thing. But they are going and they have jobs and they have careers and they, you know, have moved on. But that, you know, basically my mom had it in her head. And a lot of the women kind of, some just stayed at home moms and that's what they wanted to do. And others actually, a few like my mom, there weren't a lot of people like my mom who went and did what they in their heads had always wanted to do, but had never had the chance to do it before.
I mean, well, actually, I mean, that it actually leads into your question, which is the next project I want to do, which is definitely along the lines of Cherry Hill. I mean, it is image and essay, and it's about women not having a voice. I mean, this notion of like women are meant to sort of retreat into society, and how who are the people who didn't abide by that and who wanted to make a name for themselves, from people like your mom to people who have a certain famous status. So that's kind of what I'm researching now and looking into.
Yeah, it's women who are not just making a difference in their lives, but are making a difference in the lives of those around them. And that's the whole reason behind the podcast series, is talking to women like you who have empowered themselves, and therefore from empowering yourself, you're able then to give inspiration and help empower other women around, because we have been quiet for quite some time. And I don't mean we don't yell, and we've been, you know, the voices are in here. And it's, as we talked about before, it wasn't until the early 1970s that women were allowed to actually get credit on their own. It's amazing, because young people today couldn't imagine that, could not imagine that when you went into the city, you didn't wear pants. You know, you didn't, you couldn't wear, you know, so.
But I mean, and so much of what I'm interested in exploring, and I think I really started looking at about this in Cherry Hill, is that we absorb these messages, that women absorb these messages. You know, even like I see my friends who have young girls and young teenagers, and I think they're absorbing these societal messages about how they're supposed to come across and what they're supposed to wear. And, you know, that we don't know how much we give up of ourselves because we are trying to fulfill these somebody else's ideas. And exactly. And I really want to look at those ideas as I move forward, because I think it was very hard for me to, you know, to be this girl that had all these things that I wanted to do. I mean, I was just curious about everything. And that's why photography saved me, because photography gave me an avenue to be in many different atmospheres and environments and to really meet people from all different backgrounds and hear their stories. And that's been fascinating for me. And I will do it for as long as I can do it. And I feel like I have discovered, just in my own creative artistic progression, that this avenue to tell stories and to make images, and that I can go back in time. Photography lets me do that, you know, that's, and I can tell these stories and I can illustrate them as well. So no, I'm just, you know, I'm so excited to just do more.
Well, I can't wait. In the meantime, what is your website? I know you do have one.
Yes, it's just www.jonafrank.com.
Beautiful. Thank you so much, Jonah. This has been so interesting. And again, I can't wait for your next project, your next book, because I think it's going to be quite interesting. So again, thank you very much.
It's been lovely talking to you. Thanks so much.
Thank you for joining me today. If you liked what you heard, please share it with another person you think would be interested. And if you haven't already, please subscribe. Join me next week when I talk to another extraordinary, inspiring woman.
Today's podcast is sponsored by Upper Deck, the national full-service virtual gym that has reinvented the at-home workout experience. Upper Deck has more than 30 strength and cardio classes a week. Named Best Fitness Club in the Gold Coast for 2020, Upper Deck brings the gym to you with live coaching and motivation. Upper Deck's unique classes are interactive. They have two coaches, one leading your workout and one keeping her eyes on you, providing feedback and encouragement in real time. For a free week of unlimited virtual classes with no strings attached, email info@upperdeckfitness.com and let Upper Deck know you're a Sylvia and Me listener. This has been a Life of Prey production.